This week on Art of the Air features Grammy Award-winning country music star Steve Warner, who will discuss his visual art in the upcoming exhibit called The Flip Side. Next, leading British poet and literary biographer Fiona Sampson discussing her new book, Becoming George, The Invention of George Sand. Our spotlight's on LaPorte Arts in the Park Summer Concert Series, running through August with the executive director, Julia Maloney.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are all Wednesdays on available at our website. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And a quick program note. Beginning this week, due to changes to the radio broadcast schedule at Lakeshore Public Media, Art on the Air will no longer be heard over the airwaves on Sundays at 7 p.m. Also, our spotlight interviews that were heard on Wednesdays will no longer air as a standalone segment. However, our whole program will still be available as a podcast from the Lakeshore Public Media website, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. And, of course, on the Art on the Air website archive, breck.com/AOTA. Our spotlight interviews remain part of our whole show and will continue to be published as a standalone segment on social media every Wednesday of that show's week. The spotlight interviews are always available on demand at the Art on the Air website, breck.com/AOTA. Of course, Art on the Air continues to be heard on WVLP 103.1 FM every Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. We'd like to thank you for your understanding and continued support of Art on the Air. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight. It's a program in LaPorte County called the Arts in the Park Concert Series. And we have the executive director for that, Julia Maloney. And she's going to tell us about the whole series, some of which has already started in June, but it's a whole bunch of concerts almost every weekend running through the whole time. And she's going to tell you about it. Julia, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Larry.
Yeah, thank you for being on.
So first of all, maybe quickly tell us about the origin of this program, how many years you've been doing it and everything, and then we'll start about what we have coming up on the 2026 season.
Sure. So Arts in the Park was actually founded by a lovely couple named Bill and Kitty Wolf. That would have been in the year 2000. Actually, last year we celebrated our 25th anniversary. So it's been quite a long way since the year 2000. Their initial thought was just to raise enough funds for one more additional LaPorte City Band concert. And it just gathered so much more momentum that not only do we still help support the LaPorte City Band, but we have our own Thursday night concert series that is available to our LaPorte community for absolutely free. And we consider ourselves one of the best deals in town.
Excellent. Now, these are outdoors, correct?
Yes. We are located at the Dennis Smith Amphitheater in Fox Park off of Truesdale Avenue, close to Clear Lake in LaPorte.
Is that where it's always been? 25 years, 26 years ago?
Yes. We haven't always had a concession stand, but we do now. It was recently built in, I believe, 2020. So we have a concessions building. We have public restrooms. Yay. And we have a performer suite area for the various bands to change and have their own private area. So it's really turned into such a fantastic place, venue for an amazing series.
I've been there. There's been like ballroom dancing classes.
Oh, yeah. So as part of our kind of concert, We have a pre-concert event before the featured band that can either be, like you said, ballroom dancing, or maybe something like fitness oriented, like Zumba. Or we also showcase more local up and coming bands as that pre-concert hour as well. So the pre-concert starts at 6 p.m. It goes until 6:45. Then we have a poetry reading. We do national anthem. We have art exhibits as well. And then we have our featured band, which starts at 7 and goes until 8:30.
Excellent. Do you have a rain site in case you get rained out?
No, that is the most stressful part of my job, is just guessing what the weather is going to do. So please forgive me. I don't control the weather.
I know. I've done outdoor events and outdoor theater things. And yeah, that is always a tricky part. But we did sometimes have a venue set aside to do that. So
Julia, do you also, is Friday Tunes at Noon also by Arts in the Park?
Yes. Yes. We try and do that once a month throughout the summer. That's just literally Tunes at Noon. So it'll be on Fridays at noon at Fox Park as well.
Very good. Well, tell us a little bit about the lineup. Now, unfortunately, this show is airing in the middle of July, but you've already had a series. I mean, you have something almost every weekend. So tell us about some of the things you've had there and the dates, and then we'll talk about what you have coming up in July and August.
Sure. So June, we had an amazing Chris Stapleton tribute band called White Horse that was on June 18th. But we really try, and our season goes from the first Thursday in June through the last Thursday in August. And we really try and keep a diverse selection of genres of music for various people to come and enjoy. So we try and include some jazz, some funk, some rock, some country, oldies, of course. We have some local favorite bands like PT and the Cruisers, Cripple Creek, Middle of the Road. Lots of those are still coming up, so you haven't missed them yet. PT and the Cruisers will literally be on July 9th. And then we have another tribute band coming up on July 23rd called Peach Jam. They're an Allman Brothers tribute band. Like I said, Cripple Creek, and we'll have Middle of the Road in August. So lots that we've done, but lots to look forward to.
And they can find out information about the entire schedule at
artsinthepark.laporte.com.
Okay. Now, for next season, how, if a band says, gee, I would really like to be part of that, do they get in touch with you and say, you know, I think my band would be great? What's that process like?
Sure. So yes, there are lots of bands who actually actively reach out to me asking, you know, if we would be willing to have them. But we also have a band selection committee that takes their job incredibly seriously. It's a rather large group of volunteers that come together and kind of brainstorm what's going on in our local community, what trends in music are really popping this year or next year. And we really do go through all of the bands who have reached out to us. We do our research on if they would be a good fit. We also have surveys at the end of the season for our patrons to fill out with suggestions. Mm-hmm. So they can always, so we do take those suggestions very seriously as well, and try and get a little bit of everything that hopefully everyone will love.
Great. Well, we're in our just final moments here. Go ahead and recap the website again. And if they want to reach out to you, how they can reach you to get information, maybe directly or such as that.
Sure. So if you're interested in learning more about Arts in the Park, please visit us online at artsintheparklaporte.com. If you'd like to speak to me directly about potential band, please reach out at contact@artsinthepark.laporte.com. Thank you very much.
That's great. Well, we appreciate you coming on. Art in the Air Spotlight, Julia Maloney, Executive Director of Arts in the Park, and they have a whole series starting in June and running through August. Thank you very much for coming on our Spotlight and sharing the whole thing with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's an excellent, excellent program.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, with end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation. Ember Forge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com.
This is Howard Levy, musician, author, and educator, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are so happy to welcome Steve Warner to Art on the Air. Steve has multiple passions. He is a painter using acrylics, oils, watercolors, and sometimes encaustic in his work, but also a singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist renowned as a Grammy-winning modern-day multi-genre musical icon. 60 of his paintings will be in a solo exhibition featuring works in oil, acrylic, watercolor, and mixed media, spanning more than 30 years. His work will be at the Montehven Arts and Cultural Center in Tennessee for most of the month of July of 2026. The exhibit is titled Flipside, Paintings by Steve Warner. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Steve. It's so wonderful meeting you.
Very good to be. Thanks, Esther. Great to be with you. I love hearing aloha. That melted my heart. I love it.
It's like my favorite word in the whole world. It's just got so many meanings and nuances.
I'm glad to be with you guys. Thank you and Larry. Thanks for having me. I love talking art. It's most of the time I talk the music part of my world. I love talking the art and the creativity, you know, it's so great. And I love your glasses too, by the way.
Oh, thank you. You're so exceptional in both of those passions. Oh, you know, thanks. Your paintings, as we're going to talk about, are just really delicious.
Thank you very much.
Well, like our audience always likes to know, and that's kind of the hallmark of our show, is finding our guest's origin story. I always like to tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you're now. So tell us all about Steve.
Boy, I come from a very musical family, a large family, six kids, mom and dad, both from rural Kentucky, South Central Kentucky. My oldest brother was born there. They moved to Indianapolis for work, I think, in the 50s, which is a common theme, a common story, I believe, with a lot of folks in that time period. Came north for work, and they settled around Noblesville, Indiana, and went to school there. Early age playing music, learning music, because my father had bands and he had a regular job. He worked in a foundry. He worked in a casting company, making casting parts for automobiles and so forth. But he also, on the side, he did his passion, music. He was a fiddler, guitar player. He doodled and watercolored. And so I just grew up thinking every household did all those things, you know. I thought everybody had guitars laying around and they would
paint. And abundant art supplies.
Exactly. Paper and pencils and drawing and crayons. And so, but anyway, I've just have always done both. I've always loved both art and music, and because it's all creative and it's all arts, right? It's all the same. So, but
and they're so connected. Art and music is so connected.
And I'm sure there's books written about it, but there needs to be, if not, because there's so many parallels between writing songs and making records and making music and art. I mean, I said this the other night. I told someone, I said, it's funny, you know, with your music, people think that it's things that you want to hear. And with paintings and art, you think that it's stuff you want to see, but in both cases, it's what you feel, you know, it's all you're all doing. You're creating things that you feel more than you hear or see, really. So that's the way I look at it. But I grew up, had a wonderful art teacher. I was a Noblesville Miller. I went to Noblesville High School, and I had a great art teacher named Gordon Morrison, who took me under his wing, and I worked with him in the summers some, and he took me to Ball State to look at that school and to study art. And I met a lady named Dottie West about a year, about almost 8 months later. And she offered me a job to go on the road and tour Europe and, you know, go everywhere and tour with her, which I did. And I always say that this music thing got in the way of my art career, you know, so. But I still do both. I've always did both. I never let up on either. And I tell people this, and I mean it sincerely. I would be doing writing songs, playing music, or painting if no one ever heard or saw either one. If they didn't hear a song or see a painting, I'd still be doing it anyway, you know, because I love it.
Oh, I know. I feel the same way. Sometimes it's just such a deep calling.
So it is a passion, you know. You have to do it, you know.
So you're starting on tour, and then that whole career took you in the music direction. Maybe for a moment now, we'll explore that, you know, how you did that, how you, you know, got to be a real you know, iconic music in the country music, winning some great awards. Of course, we talked about the Grammys, but CMA yeah. and everything. But tell us about how that whole, from the start there, how that matriculated, and we'll get back to the art.
When I moved to Nashville, well, first of all, let me back up, Larry, just a moment. We were a family that, and I love it. I don't say this in a bad way, but we moved a lot. We moved all the time. We were always hip-hopping around. You know, I went to every school in our whole area, and I look back on it and say, that's what made me. That's who made me who I am, really, you know, because I was always the new kid in school, you know, always had to make new friends. And it really, we lived in Fishers. We were in Louisville once for a while. We lived in Louisville for about a year and a half. We had cousins and relatives there, but wound back up in Noblesville. But I moved to Nashville when I was about 18, with the great Dottie West. She offered me the job, and I finished my school and graduated barely, but I took one mandatory last semester course on the road, and I did finish. My class graduated, and I think I was in London or something playing that night and missed my prom and all that stuff, but didn't care because I was doing what I love to do. But thing about traveling for me, too, so much at an early age, the first time I ever was on an airplane, I flew to London. You know, and I'd never even been on a plane before in my life. And but traveling really opened my eyes and let me see the world. And I immediately started painting, you know, Big Ben. When I was in London, the first time I did a drawing of a piece of art, a painting of Big Ben. And then we play, you know, Paris, wherever you go, I just start painting, you know, and it affords me the chance to do both, you know, both passions. But Mr. Morrison, my art teacher, took me to Ball State, and that, I did, you know, I had the offer to play music, so I opted to do that. And I moved here when I was about 18, played the Grand Ole Opry when it was still at the Ryman Auditorium downtown, and immediately went on the road for 3 years playing as a part of her band.
Wow.
At the same time, I met Chet Atkins and RCA, people at RCA Records, which eventually led to me working and signing with RCA. As Chet Atkins producing my records, and he was my mentor for sure. I worked a couple of years with a guy named Bob Luman, who Luman. He was fantastic entertainer. I learned a ton from him as well. But Chet brought me to making records with RCA and Grammy nominations. I think I had 11 Grammy nominations before I even won one. And I told people I was kind of the Susan Lucci of country.
There you go.
I was nominated so many times for awards, and finally we started winning a few, and was lucky to get to go to some of the award shows and really get up and thank people, you know. And you know, I never did lose my urge or my passion for art. I would be on the road touring and have a sketchbook and watercolor supplies with me on the road. I always, even today when I go places, I always have a little watercolor kit, or at least wow. I'm sketching and taking my camera and stuff. So it's never far away from me ever. Even when I shift gears to music, I kind of just shift and fluctuate between the two worlds. And it's so fun. I feel grateful I can kind of do that these days. So.
Your songs are so, the lyrics are so poetic, you know, and one that always has stuck in my mind is move through my dreams like the wind. I mean, it's just so beautiful.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it's so, well, isn't it? So the parallel again, there it is, you know, it's about feeling. It's about, you know, that would be a lovely painting. I never thought of that, but that could be a moving through, you know, like what you just quoted, that line.
Right.
But songs for me are just poets. I mean, they're poems that, you know, you're just lucky that the music fits with it sometimes. And I always love those story songs too, the songs that really move you and songs that really strike a chord. And I feel like I've really written a song that works when someone says, oh my gosh, that's me. I'm in your song. That's me. I've done that. I've been there, you know? And so I love those songs when people connect to it, you know, and they,
yeah, it's capturing a moment with words, and then you also capture a moment with painting.
Right.
So you describe painting on the road, but did you also, like that time with Dottie West, where you also, do you have sketches of those times, like at the Grand Ole Opry, or did you have time to do that?
Not many. I do have a couple that I've saved away. My mother used to my mother, bless her heart, she was so great. There's a good Southern saying, bless her heart. But she would save everything, you know, in her cedar chest. That was her little stowaway place. But she kept some drawings from my childhood that I have, a couple of little drawings. And with Dottie West, Dottie knew my art, you know. She always would say, hey, go draw me. Paint that or draw that for me. And I would do stuff for her sometimes. But I was just a kid, too. I was 18, just turned 18, 19. I was with her 3 years. So she was like a big sis. And I tell people I went to the Dottie West Conservatory of right. Music. You know, that was my college, really. And she was wonderful. She would encourage music and art. And I painted stuff for her and like a big sister, always challenging me, too, which is great.
You know, I was going to ask you two pointed question on each of your areas in your songwriting process. And of course, I'm a retired musical theater director.
Sure.
Music comes first or lyrics? And the same thing with your art. Do you see something or do you also just have something in your head that you create out of your head? So those are kind of a two pointed question.
Yeah, Larry, here's the funny thing. Here's that parallel again. It happens both ways. Sometimes it'll happen more times than not, probably, since I feel like I'm more astute with an instrument, with a guitar. So a lot of times I'll play a riff or I'll just be sitting around playing and I'll just go, ooh, I like that way. I like the way that I played a four chord to a two chord. I like the way that felt. And then I'll just mumble a phrase or whatever, and it'll go, oh, that fit. That really glued really nicely with that guitar part. And then I'll just start piecing it together from there. And likewise with painting, you know, sometimes one method that I do painting is I'll just start with a blank canvas and I don't underpaint. A lot of times I will do an underpainting, but sometimes I don't. And I just start with a brush with a little mixture of a couple colors and just start, see where it goes, you know. And I really love that process. And it's almost like the writing process. You just throw a few things out there and see where it's going to take you. And then start wiping away. Oh, that looks like a whatever. And then wipe it away. And then it just starts forming into something, much like songs that are the same way. You know, you throw out a few words. And I love Paul McCartney's lines. I saw him speaking recently about writing. And he said, you know, it's not a real complicated thing. I'm quoting him, paraphrasing, trying to. It's not a complicated thing. I throw these words out. They sounded good with those words, and I just keep going with it. And I just keep going with the rhymes, and maybe that word rolls off the tongue a little better. And oh, I like that. And it's just, you look around and you have 3 minutes of a song or 4 minutes. And but it's really nice when those happy little accidents happen, right. And you just look up and oh wow, that turned out okay. And then the real test is when someone looks at it or hears your song and they really like it, and then they want to cut it. And one of the great thrills for me is hearing some other artists sing your song. It was,
yeah.
When I first did that when I was a young guy, it blew my mind to think that someone else would sing your words. And, you know, and I've been lucky through the years now to have cuts by Garth Brooks and Keith Urban and Kenny Rogers and all these different people through the years. And Kenny Rogers years ago cut one of my songs, and it just, I always admired him so much. He's not only a great artist, but just being around him, just super human being. I mean, just a nice, nice guy and very smart. But to hear him, to think him singing my words, it just blows you away. I still think about it today and go, I don't know how that happened, but it's incredible. So, but
plus everybody's interpretation must make you see your song in a new way each time. Absolutely. As well.
Esther, that's so right, because Kenny may sing it this way and you go, oh, I didn't write it that way, but man, is that good how he did it. And that's just the way he would do it. And you love it, you know, they make it their own. And it really is fun. And but, you know, you never know. I'm really a fan of the joy for me is just throw it out and just see where it's going to take you, you know. And sometimes I'll do more of a realism type painting where it's more like a photograph, more realistic. And then I'll really do the underpainting that way and it with like an oil or small oil or something. And then I'll just really, but I really do like the more free, loose, abstract things that you don't even know where it's going to go, you know? So, and that's the fun about hip hop in between styles, you know, too.
Right.
It's fun.
And you do that so beautifully. Like, I love that the cityscape that you did that's skewed, you know, the buildings. Like, what brought you to that? Because your landscapes are just so straightforward, you know, like the bison and the clouds. Yeah. And then you've got the cityscape that is just wild with activity and movement and color.
Thank you. I think you're referring to it's a painting I did, large painting that is called Lower East Side Looking at Brooklyn in 2020, I think, so they love it. And I think that's the one you're referring to. But that's a painting that, here's a funny story on that. It was right during COVID times. And I had an urge. First of all, I'll say I had my family living in Lower East Side of Brooklyn. I mean, Lower East Side of Manhattan. And my youngest son, who is here, he lives in California, but he's here visiting right now. He was living in Williamsburg across the river. So I had family on both sides, Brooklyn and Lower East Side. So I had the urge one day, as I do sometimes, and I thought, you know what? I want to go. I wasn't thinking in terms of that yet, but I was thinking, I just have this urge. I just need to go paint today. And every now and then I'll do that. I just got to put paint on a canvas. So I went out to the schoolhouse and I couldn't find anything large to paint on. I wanted this to be large. And I looked in my shower out there, which I never use. I just have a stack with paintings and canvases. And I pulled out this canvas out of the shower. And it was a junky old something that was just terrible. I wouldn't want anyone to see it. But the sky looked not too bad. I kind of like some of the clouds up in the left. So I just took it out and just started, bam, bam. I just started slapping stuff on it. And I took a large, long scraper, like palette knife thing, and I just went and I go, oh, that's a building, it looks like a, and then I went up, 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 and I go, the windows, you know, and I kept going, and then I go, oh, that looks like a, you know, I did just sort of, and then I go, well, that reminds me of looking across Williamsburg Bridge at Williamsburg over in Brooklyn across the river. And so I just kept, then I started going toward that, and then I made the clouds, and then I put some paper, I put down some probably like Japanese rice paper or something. I kept layering and then it just turned out. And it's funny with this show, Esther, it's funny. I had some of the folks, the curator and some people here with my show were out at our house and they were looking at paintings, and I didn't even bring that painting out because I thought that I'm not going to, they may think I've lost my mind on that one, but I pulled that painting out. They were out looking around and the one lady says, "What's that painting?" And I go, oh, this. And she saw the corner and I pulled it out. And she goes, oh, my gosh, that's got to be in your show.
I saw it and I thought, he's skipping genres. He's moved to jazz.
Jazz, for real. And so I start. So then she says, she goes, that's my favorite one I've seen all day. So anyway, that's funny how you look at it differently than someone else. And now it's one of my favorites, but it's very vibrant. And you said it, it's very animated. And it reminds me too of that crazy world that our kids were in up in New York, being quarantined up there all alone, you know, so it has meaning too. So
how did COVID affect your creative process? I mean, you know, that a lot of people kind of shut down, and then other creative people, really that was a blossoming period for them.
You know what? The latter for us. And, you know, I'll tell you why, Karen, it didn't affect us quite so much, other than we didn't get to connect with our family. You know, that's really the main way it was terrible. But other than that, I buckled down and just started learning and studying art. I just started studying with a guy over in he lives in Paris, but his wife's French, but he's from England, a guy named Stuart Davies. I started kind of following him, tagging along with him on his oils, his landscapes, and I learned a ton from him. But my wife Karen quilts, and so she just went into quilting, and she makes beautiful quilts, and I just was painting every single day, and I would do Zoom writes too. I'd never done that, but a lot of people in Nashville, they started doing Zoom writes like we're doing. We just, instead of talking right now, we'd be writing songs, and I wrote 4 or 5 songs during quarantine with an iPad like I'm on right now, and they turned out great. They turned out really cool. One of them got cut not long ago, but it didn't affect us too badly, other than missing family. But we lost some really, really close good friends because of it. But we just buckled down and got creative. And I did do something that was a lot of fun and was made me feel good that I did this too. We started a thing called Warner Wednesdays, and I would just on my iPad, every Wednesday, Karen was my camera woman, and we would go out and set up my iPad, and we didn't have any equipment. I think we had one little light or something, and didn't look great, and it was pretty crude. But every Wednesday at 7, I think, or 6, I can't remember, but I would just sit and talk and play songs and talk about how the song was written. And they're still up. They're still out there in the world of YouTube. You can find them. But we did, I think we did 28 or something episodes of Warner Wednesdays. And we had a big following from all around the world. And just every week it just grew. And so we just turned that time into trying to be very creative. And so a lot of fun.
That's the kind of thing that got us through the pandemic.
Absolutely.
I mean, everybody was doing music. I tapped into the London School of Ballet and started my morning doing ballet exercises with the Prima Ballerina, you know, so that really gave us community and connection and music and everything.
Totally. And I think I said to myself, we may be going through this terrible time, but I'm at least going to learn something while we're there, you know, and try to learn. But yeah, you're right, Esther. That's true. You just turned that into a positive. I didn't mind the solitude. I kind of liked that. Karen and I were here on our place, kind of in the country. We have 10 acres in the country here, and she had her space. I had mine. I could go paint. She could quilt. And, we turned it into positive, and the Warner Wednesdays were fun. I enjoyed doing those.
Well, unfortunately, we're in our last minute here, and I'd like to explore more, but we want to give you the opportunity, first of all, talk about your upcoming exhibit, when it is, where it is, how people can see it, and if they can visit it online, and also what you have coming down the tube in the music.
Absolutely, Larry. My show is at Mott Haven Arts and Cultural Center. It's in Hendersonville, Tennessee, a suburb of Nashville. And it's a beautiful antebellum home that is now this beautiful arts and cultural center, Mott Haven. And they are wonderful. My curator for this show is a beautiful lady named Ruth Chase, and she's a beautiful artist herself. And it's very, very smart, from the Bay Area, I think, originally. But it started the 21st of June, and it's going to run through the 26th of July. And that's 61 pieces of art, and it's in four or five different rooms in this beautiful antebellum home that's been preserved through the years. And I'm thrilled about it. We had an opening night, and I'm going to play music Thursday night, this coming Thursday, for the fundraising night. They were going to have another writer playing that night. They always have writers during their exhibitions. And I go, nope, I'm doing my own this time. I'll be my own musical guest this time. So, and they were on board, of course. So, but I love it. They're beautiful folks, and it's a really beautiful place. I hope everyone, if you're in this area, you can come to Mott Haven.
That'd be great. Well, it's our guest today, Steve Warner. The exhibit is The Flip Side, paintings by Steve Warner. You can see it at that location. We'll have a link on our page with his photo. Right. Thank you so much for coming on the Art in the Air and sharing. And of course, we'll invite you back to talk more about your music and maybe feature some of that.
Esther, thank you. Larry, thank you for, I'll come back. We'll talk music and Grammys. We'll talk. I got some funny. We'll talk about that.
Oh, Steve, it's been such a complete pleasure. Thank you so much.
My honor. Thank you, guys. Take care.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Professor Fiona Sampson to Art on the Air. Fiona is an accomplished poet, literary biographer, writer about life and place, and also a former professional violinist. She has over 30 books published, which spans poetry, biographies, academic monographs, and edited anthologies, as well as works in philosophy of language. Her critically acclaimed work has received many Book of the Year selections and has been translated into 38 languages. Her newest book, Becoming George, The Invention of George Sand, has just released. It follows the critical successes of In Search of Mary Shelley, The Girl Who Wrote Frankenstein, and Two Way Mirror, The Life of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. A book on Rousseau is in the works. As a critic, broadcaster, and librettist. She collaborates with musicians and visual artists, serves internationally on literary juries and boards of publishing houses. She is a current trustee of the Royal Literary Fund. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Fiona. I have just so thoroughly enjoyed being immersed in your words. I'm so looking forward to talking about this book.
Oh, Esther, what a lovely thing to say. And thank you for that generous introduction. And thank you to you and Larry for inviting me onto the show. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're so glad to get across the pond and get our times all worked out this time. Our audience always wants to know the background of our guests. I call it their origin story. So tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Well, as you pointed out, and as you can hear, I'm a Brit. And within that, I'm partly English, but partly Welsh, because I grew up mainly in Wales, which, like many countries, sees itself as the land of song. And I was lucky. I had a very charismatic teacher in primary school, in the village school, who introduced us when I was six and knew nothing about anything to Dylan Thomas. And I was completely blown away by the music of the start of Under Milkwood, which, of course, is a fabulous piece of work, but also quite rude. But of course, that went over my head at six. I just thought, this is extraordinary. This is what I want. This is what it's all about. And then it took a long time to sort of get back to that because, you know, when I was getting to leaving school, there was no sense that as a woman with, or young girl with no particular connections from the provinces, there was no sense that you could be a writer. That was, forgive me the cliche, but it was for dead white men and for people in general who had more glamorous lives than mine. So I became a concert violinist, and that was amazing. And I was a chamber musician, and I loved it. And there's a strong interpretive kind of element in all my work, in all my life. I've done a lot of editing, and I adore editing. I've done a lot of literary translation. I do all that too. And biography too, I think, is a form of interpretation. They're all kind of having a feeling with, a feeling through another artist's work. But when I was in my mid-20s, I went to Oxford and read politics and philosophy and economics and won their Newdigat Prize, which is a kind of very romantic prize to win, which all sorts of people like Tennyson have won in the past. And actually, for example, in the States, Donald Hall, when he was a Fulbright, won the Newdigat when he was in Oxford. And I became a poet while working on my PhD, which was applying philosophy of language to the question of what is poetry for? What is it and what is it for? What is it is doing that's different from prose? How do we know a poem as a poem? Which are questions which are both, like all philosophical questions, both very obvious and very, very hard to kind of pin down. And I did that because I had been already working with poetry in healthcare settings, particularly mental healthcare settings. It was a time when the arts in Britain were being really brought out of conventional settings and taken into prisons and schools and hospitals. And I was lucky to do the pilot, which was with creative writing in a whole range of healthcare settings, and write the national report. And I became more and more interested in how art, all the arts, are perhaps earn their keep, as it were, in the moments of great crisis in life, when we are, in England, we say hatches, matches and dispatches. You know, everyone turns to a poem for their wedding, for their funeral service, for baptisms, naming ceremonies. And I still retain that sense of the real importance of, the almost visceral importance of the arts and their intense recognizability, regardless of your class, your education, your cultural background. The real thing kind of speaks. It may be extraordinary and difficult when you first encounter, but it speaks to you.
It's true. You know, there's a musicality to words and the visual arts as well as the violin. So were you still playing?
No, not at all. All or nothing. You know, it's 5-6 hours a day when you're a concert violinist. And you can't do anything else around it. I mean, you can have a life, but you can't develop another expertise alongside it. So and then I, you know, began to publish, and then I began to publish in other genres, and then I had various fellowships looking at this area and then looking at other areas. I became very interested in poetry and translation. I set up an international poetry festival in Wales. So I really like collaboration and conversation. And I also can't really understand why, if you love poetry or the arts or whatever, you wouldn't have curiosity, which is obviously, I mean, what you guys do. I mean, you have an appetite, a curiosity for knowing more of what's going on, knowing always more. There's always more to know. Never to sort of stick with what you know, your particular genre, your particular a few named writers that you return to over and over. One does that too, but right, always wanted to know more.
Voracious appetite for learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And so then I began to, I worked as a director of a Stephen Spender Memorial Trust, which is a trust for literature and translation in the UK. And then I became the editor of Poetry Review, which is our equivalent of Poetry Chicago. It's our national poetry magazine of record, adored doing that. Published books for translation, began to write prose, wrote a lot of critical prose. I mean, you know, live reviewing, not only academic prose, but writing in ways that you hope will engage the readers of a national newspaper so they will go out and buy the book. They will, you know, engage. They won't think it's just a kind of coterie talking to themselves. Just always sort of turning outwards, trying to make the conversation enlarged all the time. And then gradually moving into writing about place and so on. And you're probably wondering why George Sand. And George Sand is the third, exactly, in a trilogy of biographies I've written of romantic women writers who what they have in common is that they each wrote extraordinary and really at the time significant and still very significant today bodies of work. And yet each of them is being slightly, has a tendency to be slightly elbowed out of the canon. We tend to slightly forget about them. So Mary Shelley, whose Frankenstein masterpiece is obviously not forgotten about, but there's still this strand in sort of thinking about Frankenstein. Oh, maybe Mary Shelley kind of had the idea, but Percy Bysshe Shelley had to sort it all out for her.
Right.
Kind of terrible, reductive, and flying absolutely in the face of the evidence, because you can look at the Frankenstein notebooks. They're free to view online. British Library has them all, scanned, not just transcribed, but scanned. You can see the originals online for free. You don't have to remember the library or anything. You can just go and look. You can see whose handwriting is whose. The little notes by Percy, but that's all. Then Elizabeth Barrett Browning, wonderful poet who really shifted from Romanticism to Victorian poetry and is oddly better known in the States than she is now in Britain, where she's somewhat forgotten. But in the States, I discovered, she's still sort of on the university syllabus more. You know, again, a woman who is regarded by many critics as kind of an impediment to her husband, who was a real poet, Robert Browning. And yet in her time, she, you know, people wanted her. There was a movement to appoint her the poet laureate and so on. Of course, we had to wait another sort of 150 or more years to have a female poet laureate in Britain. But, you know, these are women who made extraordinary contributions, who were bestsellers in their lifetime, critically regarded, and yet we want to edge them out. Same thing with George Sand, a huge figure in European culture. And yet, largely what's remembered of her is that she had an affair with Chopin. I mean, it's so reductive.
Excellent.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media on WVLP 103.1 FM. Yes, in one sense, but it also is so freeing for her as well. I mean, if it wasn't for, I mean, and I knew about George Sand before the movie Impromptu happened with the brilliant Judy Davis as George Sand. And there was so in your book, the line, and I'm just going to have to read from it because I want to accurately, I began to love him when I saw him suffering. She's talking about her brother, her baby brother. But I'm wondering if some of that was also, that's why she was so attracted to Chopin. Beside his music was that he was also quite ill. And so I don't know. I saw that tie in between
that's a really
them.
Interesting. Like,
enraptured by his illness as well as his music.
No, Esther, that's a really interesting, yes, that's a really interesting thought, because obviously it was her pattern to go for frail, often also financially dependent younger men. And as she got older, the age gap got greater. So she was looking for a kind of frail youth. And you're absolutely right. Of course, Chopin, when she and Chopin started their relationship in 1838, Chopin was, let's say, chesty, bronchial. And the year after their relationship ended, in 47, he died of tuberculosis. And she did a lot of work of nursing him, a lot of work of keeping him alive, a lot of work of keeping him financially through the sales of her incredibly, she was so productive, her very high rate of production of novels, so that he didn't have to go on tour and he could just kind of preserve his strength and stay at home and compose. And in fact, her last partner, her last long relationship after Chopin, 15 years with Alexandre Monceau, who was an engraver who was a lot younger than her, he died of TB while they were together. So, I mean, also, there was a lot of it about in those days. But yes, it's definitely a sense of being attracted to, she talks about a maternal tenderness. And it's so interesting you think about her brother, because one of the things I also think about is her husband. You know, when she's 17, she married another sort of member of the country gentry, when she didn't yet know she was going to be George Sand, you know, wanted to have an ordinary life as a country châtelaine and couldn't really sustain it, was bored. But also he became boorish and drunk and eventually violent. And I've always thought that, and also she had an adored elder half-brother, illegitimate, who was quite masculine and quite a drinker, and he too died an alcoholic. And I think that she saw kind of a more robust masculinity as kind of scary, maybe almost dysfunctional like that, and she wanted something more delicate and controllable. But you're right. I mean, she was obviously ferociously envious as a little four-year-old of her baby brother, and could only love him when she saw how frail he was.
Well, you know, what she did too is, and I think it's part of the whole thing, is define the 19th century norms, the gender norms, and by wanting to do that. So why don't you speak to that? That's a large part of the story here, is that, it's a deliberate choice to do that, to become that, and smoke cigars and dress in male attire, and what drove her creativeness to do that?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that we shouldn't forget, because for us, like, the cravats and the cigars are really visible, but to almost invisible to us in a way, is because we now accept it as so normal, is what was also incredibly sort of gender transgressive for her at the time, which was writing novels, being a professional writer. Right. You know, she had a desk at the Figaro. I mean, that was unheard of for a woman. And she sort of adopted the uniform of the other literati, who were all male, around her. I think you're absolutely right that it's defining, but I think that her courageousness and her refusal to play by the rules isn't really so much about particularly sexuality. I think her sexuality is really, you know, she was promiscuous, but I mean, so was everyone in Bohemia, in Paris at the time. It's just that the women didn't become famous and the men were allowed to. So we sort of think that she's a special case. But actually what she was trying to do in a way almost was adopt the camouflage of looking like a guy. She wanted to be one of the guys. She wanted to be,
was brilliant, because they saw her that way. They didn't, I mean, they accepted her because of the garb that she was wearing, where, if, you know, it's just so fascinating, actually.
It is, isn't it? And extraordinary, because, you know, she was, it's very interesting. Obviously, there are the usual kind of misogynist and disgusting, quite ad feminine comments about her by some of her male peers. But at the same time, there is extraordinary literary esteem from everyone, from Matthew Arnold to Victor Hugo to Balzac to Flaubert. They all thought she was, didn't just think, oh, she's an interesting cultural phenomenon, or indeed, oh, she's good company, or, well, she's prolific, but there, she's a woman. They thought she was an extraordinary literary figure. And they were right, because she was shifting the novel. She was shifting the novel form, as some of them Hugo and Balzac particularly were shifting the novel form into something kind of like a kind of panoply in the kind of Dickensian way. The city with its dysfunction and its underclass, creating its own underclass and its cruelties and its, you know, large and life characters. But she was equally politically engaged in her writing and indeed in some of her activism, like founding progressive periodicals, but she's doing it from feeling, from what it would be like to feel those experiences.
Fiona, do you think her social consciousness was realized during her time, or like King Charles, dismissed early and recognized later?
You know? No, I think it was. I mean, I think, you know, particularly in the 40s, she becomes very politically active. She is, you know, leading up to 48, she founds three progressive periodicals. She campaigns for Fanchette's, a really awful story of a young woman with learning difficulties, as we call it in Britain, who is thrown out by her local convent. The nuns have raised her, you know, she was orphaned or whatever, was abandoned, a foundling. And sure enough, when she turns up a few weeks later, she's obviously been abused and she's pregnant, and she lacks the capacity to consent. She's, you know, she's got a learning difficulty. And Georges writes about this case, publicizes this case, raises money for Fanchette. And so she's really quite active. And she's also active not only in local politics, but in local good works, which is perhaps more traditional role for a chatelaine of a country manor. But I mean, these aren't famous grand gestures. These are sort of really living by her principles. So I think that I don't think it's reconstructive. I think around gender, I mean, she has, her pronouncements are fairly sort of personal but clear, you know, take me for a man or a woman as you like. She's not trying to play with sexuality particularly. She's not trying to express herself. She's saying, I want a gender neutral opportunity. Right. And, you know, I want that in terms of being free to go around the city in Paris and not be, you know, harassed. I want to be able to go to the theatre freely. I want to publish freely. I want to be able to make the choices that I make. So she's in that sense a very flexible and inspiring role model. You know, she isn't just let's worry about this particular aspect of women's rights or gender identity. She is a quite an inclusive model, and she's showing us something about creative disobedience, which is, you know, a call to arms for all writers and makers.
You know, something I gathered from your book, in the English-speaking world, she actually had more, so a prolific writer that she outsold Victor Hugo at the time. And I found that amazing.
And for example, the Brontes were huge fans. I mean, Wuthering Heights is a Sandian novel, only it lacks the kind of grit of George Sand's politics. It's just got the love story.
Right.
Whereas George Sand would have an idea about arranged marriage or society or whatever. So she's, she's very brave and fascinating. And we also mustn't forget her ecological writing later in life, in the 1850s and 60s, essays in which she really apprehends the way the natural world is. She apprehends the notion of an ecosystem and its interdependence and its independence from the human. So really exciting.
So do you have a brief reading for us?
Yes, I'd love to read you a little bit just from towards the end of the book. Gustave Flaubert tells Turgenev that he, quotes, wept like a calf at her funeral, quotes, the first time when I kissed her granddaughter Aurore, whose eyes that day were so like hers as to be a kind of resurrection, the second, when I saw her coffin carried past. The good country people wept copiously around the grave. We were up to our ankles in mud in the little village cemetery, and a gentle rain was falling. Her funeral was like a chapter in one of her books. If interment is a final homecoming, Georges' final home is no more. And after all, as Flaubert tells Turgenev, why pity her? She had everything life had to offer and will remain a very great figure. But as she said, love and pity go together. And even as he writes this, it's as if he's still standing at the graveside in the rain, hat in his hands, with his coat wet and his hair drenched, to ruminate on and honour his old friend. It was to her, old Flaubert, that the living Georges had written in October 1871, what stands as an explanation of her life and work. Quotes, "One fine day, I found myself with, don't laugh, childish, innocent principles that have stayed with me through everything. To love, to sacrifice oneself, never to withdraw unless the sacrifice comes to harm the people it's meant to benefit, and then to sacrifice oneself again in the hope of serving a true cause, love. I'm talking now not of personal passion, but of love of the human race, of an extension of self-love that abhors concentration on the self. Human instinct is love, and whoever omits love omits truth and justice." It is a kind of lovely ending point, isn't it?
It is.
Sure is. Well, we have only just about a minute and a half left, and we want to give you the opportunity to talk about where people can find your book and also more about you online, a website, other connections like that, other works.
Well, so Becoming George, The Invention of George Sand is by me, and it's published by Norton, came out on the 23rd of June, and all good bookshops and Amazon. And I'm also a poet, and my most recent poetry collection in English won 3 international prizes and is called Come Down and is published by Hachette. And I'm easy to find online on Facebook. My website is fionasampson.co.uk.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show. And of course, like Esther indicated, I think we will have you back focused on your poetry. We wanted to make sure we got this one out on time. Fiona Sampson, the newest work is Becoming George, The Invention of George Sand. And you can find it at bookstores anywhere. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm glad we reconnected after our misconnection last week. And thank you so much, Fiona, for coming on and sharing your book and your wonderful background.
Thank you so much, Larry. Thank you so much, Esther. It's a joy.
Oh, gosh, I just want to talk to you for hours more about this book in the future.
I know, there's always so much to say, isn't there? But, you know, obviously you can't. But well, thank you so much, guys. That was lovely.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is on Lakeshore Public Media and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are on Wednesdays, available at our website, thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.